Good to see everyone this morning. Very happy to be with you. Very happy to be able to worship God with you. And we're glad for the presence of our visitors. We've had several who've been out of town and on vacations, various trips, various kinds. And we're glad that everybody has made it back safe and sound. And good to have everyone with us. The Apostle Paul once said, "For whatever was written in earlier times was written for our instruction, so that through perseverance and the encouragement of the Scriptures, we might have hope." We have been talking in our auditorium class about things written in past times, things written in both the Old Testament and the New Testament that God has preserved for us. And indeed, we are able to receive instruction from what God has preserved for us in His Word. And from that, we do receive encouragement and perseverance, and indeed we do have hope. It's important for us, as someone said recently, to read what has been preserved and learn from that and apply that. And that's why I'd like us to look this morning at one particular example of something preserved in the Old Testament for us, a particular narrative that I find very interesting and intriguing, the story of Cain and Abel. It's recorded for us in Genesis chapter 4, and Jeremy just a moment ago read to us the basic account there in Genesis chapter 4 about Cain and Abel. And there are several places in Scripture where this particular narrative is alluded to by New Testament writers, and I think there are some important lessons for us to look at. So I'd like to consider for a few moments what is found here in Genesis chapter 4 regarding Cain and Abel. And I want to start out by just pointing out to you that the account of Cain and Abel in Genesis chapter 4 is really part of a unit of material in the book of Genesis that goes back to Genesis chapter 2 verse 4 and goes to the very end of chapter 4. And the book of Genesis is divided up into various sections, and those sections are introduced by statements like what you see here as the introduction of this particular unit of material. In Genesis chapter 2, verse 4, we read, "These are the generations of the heavens and the earth when they were created." These are the generations. When you look throughout the book of Genesis, there are numerous times where you will see a new unit of material, a new section, being introduced by that kind of phraseology. These are the generations of so-and-so. We read about the generations of Adam, the generations of Noah, the generations of Shem, the generations of Ishmael and of Isaac and so on. And this particular section of Genesis, the first major section after the prologue, the creation account in Genesis chapter 1, basically, it begins with this heading, "These are the generations of the heavens and the earth when they were created." And what you see here is an account of various things that happen in this very initial period of time when the heavens and earth were newly born, when human beings had just recently been created by God. And so in this section, we read about the creation of Adam and Eve. There's a more detailed account of God making the male and the female than what we receive in the prologue account in Genesis chapter 1. There's an account of the sin of Adam and Eve in Genesis chapter 3. This section of material then goes on to talk about Cain and Abel and how Cain slays Abel, his brother, and that's the material that we want to focus in on this morning in this lesson. And then there is an account about the lineage of Cain versus the lineage of Seth. And so this is this initial section of material in the book of Genesis, and the story of Cain and Abel is a part of that section. So with that introduction in mind, I'd like us to look at what Genesis chapter 4 has to say about these two brothers and what happened with them. The text says, beginning in verse 2, that Abel was a keeper of flocks, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. So it came about in the course of time that Cain brought an offering to the Lord of the fruit of the ground. Abel, on his part, also brought of the firstlings of his flock and of their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and for his offering. But for Cain and for his offering, he had no regard. Now, that's an interesting account here as we begin to read about this. These two boys, we don't know exactly how old they are at this particular time, but they both have different livelihoods, and both of them offer up a sacrifice from their respective livelihoods. Abel was a keeper of flocks, and he offered up an animal sacrifice, and Cain was a farmer, and he offered up from the fruit of the ground. But the text says that God had regard for Abel's offering, but did not have regard for Cain's offering. And I don't know how it was that God indicated that. Some have suggested that God ignited the altar of Abel to indicate he was accepting that offering. Maybe that's the point. The text doesn't actually say that. It may just be that God communicated in some way, like he communicated elsewhere in the narrative, that he had regard for Abel's sacrifice, but not for Cain's. However it was, God indicated that he had regard for Abel's offering, but he had no regard for Cain's offering. Why is that the case? Why didn't God have regard for Cain's offering? There are several suggestions that people have offered to explain that. Some have suggested, I've heard this all of my life, that this is an example of an individual who failed to follow God's instructions. It must have been, it is usually said, that God had told both of these boys that they were to offer up an animal sacrifice, and Abel obeyed God and fulfilled God's instructions, but Cain disobeyed God and did not offer up an animal sacrifice, but instead offered up a sacrifice from the fruit of the ground. And so he did not follow God's instructions. So maybe that's the reason why God did not have regard for Cain's sacrifice. It's possible, though, that that's not the idea. It does seem like that both of these boys are offering up to God that which related to their respective livelihood, that they were both they both had different occupations, and so they were thanking God for his blessings, and so they were offering up an offering from their respective livelihoods. But maybe this first suggestion is the reason why God did not have regard for Cain's offering. Maybe so, maybe not. Another possibility is that maybe Cain did not give God the very best that he had. Maybe it wasn't so much that his sacrifice was not according to God's instructions, but it was that Abel, as the text says, offered God from the firstlings of his flock and of their fat portions. That is, the very best of his flock. But the text just says Cain gave an offering from the fruit of the ground. And so maybe the point is he did not give God the very best that he had, and yet his brother did. Maybe that is the point. Another suggestion is that Cain had not been living righteously prior to this, and that's why the Lord did not accept his offering when he gave it. And it's possible that this is the point being made in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 4, where there the Hebrew writer says, by faith, Abel offered a better sacrifice to God than Cain, through which he obtained the testimony that he was righteous. So you could understand that statement by the Hebrew writer to mean that God was indicating by this that Abel had been living righteously previously, but the fact that God did not have any regard for Cain's sacrifice, that was God's way of showing him that Cain had not been living righteously prior to this point in time. So that's a possibility. Maybe 1 John chapter 3, verse 12 also indicates the same thing. There John says that Cain slew his brother, and why did he slay him? because his deeds were evil. That is, Cain's deeds were evil. So maybe that's the point. So here are three suggestions as to why God did not have regard for Cain's sacrifice. I'm not exactly sure which of these maybe is the reason. Maybe all of these or more than one of these. But in any case, I want us to see that Cain did not offer a sacrifice that God took note of, that God regarded, that God was pleased with. And so what we see then is Cain's reaction. In verse 5, the text says, "So Cain became very angry, and his countenance fell. Then the Lord said to Cain, 'Why are you angry, and why has your countenance fallen? If you do well, will not your countenance be lifted up? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door, and its desire is for you, but you must master it.'" To me, this is a very interesting point in the narrative. Because what you see here is that God gives Cain some counsel. It's like a father who's going to a child, and he sees the child is upset. And in this instance, God's child, Cain, is upset with God, or at least the fact that God didn't have regard for his offering, but he regarded his brother's offering. And the text says Cain is angry about this, and his countenance has fallen. He's depressed about all of this, and God counsels him. God's concerned about it. And he says to him, here's what you need to do as you deal with your anger and your frustration and your depression when life has not turned out the way that you expected, that you wanted. And here's a good lesson, folks, for all of us. And I've made this point many times in sermons, but I think it bears repetition. Because right here in the very beginning of human history, God was addressing and giving counsel concerning a very common human problem. Sometimes we're angry about life. Sometimes we're depressed about life. And in no way do I want to suggest by my comments here that I am minimizing the real physiological problems that some people have with clinical depression. Sometimes there's good reason to be on some kind of medication due to some physiological problem. That's not what I'm talking about. But what I am talking about is what you see here illustrated by Cain. Here's an individual whose life was not turning out as he had wanted, and he's upset about that and depressed about that and melancholy about that. And God says to him, if you do well, will not your countenance be lifted up? That's such an important lesson. It's an important lesson because so often we can become so focused upon ourself and how I feel. And I'm upset with how things have gone with me in my life. And we were made by God to look outside of ourselves and to not be a selfish person, not some egoistic kind of person, but instead we were made by God to be a person who looks outside of himself or herself toward other people. We were called upon to do good things for other people, for God, for his cause, for the benefit of God's people. And God says to Cain, if you do well, your countenance is going to be lifted up. There's a residual benefit that accrues to us when we stop being selfish and stop being focused upon ourselves and look outside of ourselves toward other people. There is a residual benefit that comes back to us. We feel better. And our spirits are buoyed up. Our spirits are lifted up. God told that to Cain. He also said, if you do not do well, if you don't heed my counsel on this occasion, you need to recognize sin is crouching at the door and its desire is for you, but you must master it. In other words, what he was saying to Cain was, you're at a very crucial point in your life right now. This is serious business right here, Cain. How are you going to handle it? If you handle it by doing well, things are going to go good for you and you're going to feel better about everything. But if you do not do well, You need to understand there's a dangerous circumstance here because sin, like a wild animal, is crouching at the door, and its desire is for you. It wants to get you, but you've got to master it. And God says, by implication, yes, you can master sin. Yes, you can overcome it. There are so many times when we fall to sin and we justify ourselves. Well, I'm just a human being and I just couldn't help it. God says, yes, you can help it. And he says, you must master it. Now, God wasn't saying it was going to be easy. But God is telling Cain and counseling Cain about how to go about dealing with this circumstance so he can master sin, so he can overcome the dangerous circumstance that he was in. Well, how did Cain respond to God's counsel? Well, the text says in verse 8 that Cain said to Abel, his brother, "Let us go out to the field." And when they were in the field, Cain rose up against his brother Abel and killed him. And the Lord said to Cain, "Where is Abel, your brother?" He said, "I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper?" Folks, Cain did not heed God's counsel. He didn't master sin. Instead, he was overcome by sin. And you know how he did it? He sought a place of seclusion. He sought a place of seclusion. In Genesis 4 and verse 8, as we just read, the text says, when they were in the field, Cain rose up against his brother Abel and killed him. It's horrendous what we're reading in the text. This brother, far from doing well as God had counseled him, instead allowing his bitterness and his anger and his focus upon himself and his desires to become so paramount that he got angrier and angrier and more frustrated to the point where he finally kills his own brother. That's horrendous in and of itself. What I want you to understand, though, is he had his brother go out into a field so he could do his deed there. Why did he do that? Why did he want his brother to come out into this field? Isn't it obvious he was wanting to get away from the others? He wanted a place of solitude, a place of seclusion. And folks, one lesson that we learn from this account of Cain and Abel is that that's the way sin always works. Sin masters us by seeking some place of seclusion, away from the eyes of other people, because we become deceived into thinking that if we are in a place of seclusion, then nobody's going to know. And that's where sin can thrive, in a place of seclusion, in a place of solitude. I'm reminded of what Jesus said to Nicodemus in John chapter 3 and verse 20. You recall when Nicodemus had come to him by night. And Jesus talked to him about all of this. And he said in verse 20, "Everyone who does evil hates the light and does not come to the light for fear that his deeds will be exposed." That's just the way that sin works. Sin doesn't want to be out there in the open where everybody can see. Sin wants to be in a place of seclusion, or as Jesus uses the figure here, a place of darkness, where again, darkness provides that cover and darkness provides that seclusion. Because that way, sinful deeds, we think, are not going to be exposed. And folks, we need to understand something, that that's the way sin works. And Cain should have recognized, even before he ever rose up against his brother, that he was preparing to sin by taking his brother into a field, into a place of seclusion. And it's pretty obvious that deep down in his heart, that's what was going on in his mind the entire time. Is that the way it is in our lives? Do we find ourselves gravitating towards some area of seclusion away from where other Christians are, where they would see, away from people who would look down on what we're doing? Do we maybe find solace in association with those people who are parties to that kind of sin that we want to practice? But do we maintain a seclusion from those people who will look down upon us? If that's what we're doing, that's exactly what Cain did. That's how sin works. That's how sin functions. And I'll tell you something else along this line, folks. It's not just an issue of moral things, or rather immoral things, being done in darkness or in seclusion. In 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 1, Peter talked about false teachers and false prophets. And he said, there will also be false teachers among you who will secretly introduce destructive heresies. And notice that adverb that he uses there. Secretly will introduce destructive heresies. Folks, may I say to you that false teaching doesn't occur when a teacher gets up into a pulpit and has a big FT for false teacher on his shirt. There's no ID badge that says, hello, my name is false teacher so-and-so. And it's not necessarily someone who gets up into a pulpit or addresses a big group of people like this. We need to understand what Peter was saying is that false teachers, they introduce destructive heresies secretly. And it seems to me what he's really talking about is not addressing a group of people, but instead the seclusion of just a few people here that I'm talking with. And that's when false teaching is most dangerous. Because that's where it doesn't have the protection of wide-ranging exposure so that the falsity of the teaching might be pointed out by those who can see through its error. Let me just take a moment to address something that I think is a real problem in our society today. And that's the problem with the internet. And it's not just that I'm talking about the normal problems that we think of with the internet, such as pornography on the internet, and that, of course, is another area of seclusion in one's own home and all that kind of immoral thing. Yes, that's a major, major problem. But on this occasion, I just want to make mention of the fact that one thing that I see as a major problem among young people, especially in our day, is the opportunity to chat online and have discussions online about all sorts of biblical things. And sometimes these young people, because of their youth and because of their inexperience, don't have any knowledge of what they're really talking about. They think they do. They're talking to other people who are young and are talking as if they know what they're talking about in regard to this issue or that issue. And yet, in their online chatting, in their, and I forget now the terminology of all this stuff. My wife knows because she looks at all this stuff. And what am I trying to think of? These blogs and the MySpace and all that kind of stuff. And old fogies like me never, I just called my wife an old fogey. Oh my goodness. Male old fogies like me never look at that stuff. But when it has been called to my attention, I go on there and I see there are all sorts of young Christian people who are discussing all sorts of issues. And people that are knowledgeable about those things aren't involved in that discussion. And I'm not suggesting that the young people are purposely trying to discuss it with other young people so that older folks won't know. That may be the case in certain instances, but that's not even what I'm talking about. I'm just talking about this is the way that false ideas can easily permeate. Because those people who would be able to see the falseness, they're not there. They're not involved. And the teaching is done with a measure of seclusion away from those people who could see through the error. And this is just a real problem. I'm going to tell you what, there's a young man right now that I know personally who through this method that we're talking about is convincing a lot of young people that the Bible is not the inspired Word of God. It's not the inerrant Word of God. You can't rely upon the Bible as your authority. Quit trying to go back to the Bible and try to read the Bible and do what the New Testament Christians did. He's convincing a lot of young people that won't work. And instead of all things, this young man is trying to convince other young people to join the Anglican Church. Because at least it goes back in time a little bit closer to the first century church. He's causing a lot of problems. You didn't know about that. Because most of you are old fogies like me. But a lot of those young people who are looking at MySpace and blogs and part of these things, they know what I'm talking about. This is how false teaching works. This is how sin works. It seeks seclusion. It's away from the eyes of those who could correct it and see through it. And that's what God is teaching us in this story of Cain. And of course, Cain's response to God, "Am I my brother's keeper?" What a classic statement. We could talk a long time about that, couldn't we? Yeah, we are to be our brother's keeper. Yes, we are supposed to be our brother's keeper. Yes, we are supposed to love our neighbor and love our brother. And that's why in Galatians 5, verse 14, there the Apostle Paul said, "The whole law is fulfilled in one word, in the statement, you shall love your neighbor as yourself." That's why God said that. That's why all of the law and the prophets, Jesus said, really hinge upon two commandments: love God and love your neighbor as yourself. Yes, we are to be the keeper of our brother. And it's not just the idea of, well, not murdering our brother the way Cain did. And I've talked about this recently in Matthew chapter 5. Jesus said in response to what the Pharisees were teaching, just make sure you don't murder someone, and that way you won't have violated God's commandment. Jesus said, "I say to you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. You've heard that the ancients were told, 'You shall not commit murder,' and whoever commits murder shall be liable to the court. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be guilty before the court, and whoever says to his brother, 'You good for nothing,' shall be guilty before the Supreme Court, and whoever says, 'You fool,' shall be guilty enough to go into the fiery hell." In other words, Jesus is talking about not just refraining from murdering your brother, but he's talking about how sin can master us by allowing us to become so angry and getting our anger worked up where we say things that are hurtful and spiteful, just intended to put the other person down. And I might emphasize the fact that his point here is not these particular epithets, fool, as if that's the only way you could violate this, or calling someone a good-for-nothing, or some of your versions may render that empty-headed. He's just using some examples of insults that people in his day would commonly use. And he's saying, that's not the way you treat your brother, your neighbor, someone who's made in the image of God like you, who is a child of God like you. And that's what Cain really understood. He just didn't want to admit that it was true. Am I my brother's keeper? Sure he was. And he knew what he did was wrong. That's why he did it in seclusion. But he's trying to rationalize it. And what God was saying to him, in effect, was, yes, you are your brother's keeper. And we all need to learn that. And the Lord said, "What have you done? The voice of your brother's blood is crying to me from the ground." And now you are cursed from the ground, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you till the ground, it shall no longer yield its strength to you. You shall be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth. Cain said to the Lord, "My punishment is greater than I can bear. Behold, thou hast driven me this day away from the ground, and from thy face I shall be hidden, and I shall be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth, and whoever finds me will slay me." Then the Lord said to him, "Not so. If anyone slays Cain, vengeance shall be taken on him sevenfold." And the Lord put a mark on Cain, lest any who came upon him should kill him. Then Cain went away from the presence of the Lord. What was Cain's punishment? Well, Cain's punishment was that he would be cursed from the ground that received Abel's blood. In other words, here's a man whose livelihood was receiving produce from the ground. Instead of watering the ground to bring forth his crop, on this occasion, it was the blood of his brother that the earth swallowed up. And the Lord said, "I am not going to allow the ground to continue to produce for you. No, not when you've poured your brother's blood down into the mouth of the ground. Instead, you are cursed from the ground that received the blood of your brother Abel." And so what that meant was is that no longer was Cain able to live that kind of sedentary life, that life of relative ease, but instead he would have to be a wanderer, a vagabond, on the earth, like a nomadic kind of lifestyle. And the main thing that we see from all this is it would be a nomadic lifestyle away from the presence of God itself. This is as far removed from the Garden of Eden as it could be. The Garden of Eden was that place, that garden, that sedentary lifestyle where the ground was producing all these good things and God was present therein. And now we see God doing more than just excluding Cain from Eden like had happened with Adam and Eve. Instead, he is living a nomadic lifestyle away from the presence of God in a much fuller extent. Folks, what I want you to think about as we bring this to a close is what Cain's response was. What was his response to this punishment? May I suggest to you, first of all, that he failed to appreciate God's mercy. He failed to appreciate God's mercy. You know what God could have done with Cain that he didn't? He could have executed him right then and there. He didn't do it. Oh, but Cain said, "Oh, but my punishment is greater than I can bear. I'm going to be a fugitive and a vagabond on the earth. And in fact, my life will be in danger." That's all he's thinking about. He didn't realize how merciful God already had been to him. And God even continues to be merciful and put some kind of a sign on him, a mark, so that anyone who would find him would recognize he was not to be executed. Look at the mercy God was showing him. Doesn't seem to me that Cain appreciates that. And may I also say this, when you look at these latter verses in this section of Genesis, that we see what Cain's lineage and his legacy ultimately turn out to be. In Genesis chapter 4, as I said to you at the very beginning of this lesson, in verses 17 to the end of this chapter, we see the lineage of Cain. And it's a lineage where various ones are named, and it all culminates with this seventh one in the lineage, Lamech. And look at what the text says about him, this descendant of Cain. Verse 19 says, "Lamech took to himself two wives. The name of the one was Ada, and the name of the other Zillah. Ada gave birth to Jabal. He was the father of those who dwell in tents and have livestock. His brother's name was Jubal. He was the father of all those who play the lyre and the pipe. As for Zillah, she also gave birth to Tubal-Cain, the forger of all implements of bronze and iron. Verse 23 then says, Lamech said to his wives, Ada and Zillah, listen to my voice. You wives of Lamech, give heed to my speech, for I have killed a man for wounding me and a boy for striking me. If Cain is avenged sevenfold, then Lamech 77-fold. Now, these verses that I've just read, those are verses at the end of this section of material in this opening portion of Genesis, where it's contrasting this lineage and therefore the legacy of Cain with the lineage and the legacy of Adam's other son, Seth, whom God gave in the aftermath of Abel's death. And when you keep reading, when you look at what is said about Seth, it says in verses 25 and 26, Adam had relations with his wife again, and she gave birth to a son and named him Seth, for she said, God has appointed me another offspring in place of Abel, for Cain killed him. To Seth, to him also a son was born, and he called his name Enosh. Now watch it. Then men began to call upon the name of the Lord. Then men began to call upon the name of the Lord. That's Seth's lineage. Men of Seth's lineage are the ones who are said to have begun to call upon the name of the Lord and to serve him. What about Cain's lineage? What was his legacy? Well, he had some famous people. He had some famous descendants. And they started various things that human society looked back on and took note of. One was the father of those who dwelt in with herds and livestock. One was the forger of bronze materials. One was the first one who began to play the lyre and the pipe and musical instruments like that. And from the world's point of view, some notable people. But they didn't call upon the name of the Lord. Lamech, he has two wives, and he kills somebody. Text doesn't go into detail, but kills somebody like Cain had done. In fact, even sets up his own warning that he just establishes, well, nobody better take my life and try to execute me, or I call upon vengeance sevenfold. Not just sevenfold like was the case with Cain. Famous people in Cain's lineage. Tough people in Cain's lineage. People that the world would look upon as notable people. But it's only those people associated with Seth's lineage where it said they began to call upon the name of the Lord. Folks, what's your legacy going to be? What are we teaching our children? What are our children's children going to be like? I think so often we're concerned with our children being successful in this world's eyes, in the way this world measures success. And yet, we're not as concerned as we should be about our children being brought up in the nurture and discipline of the Lord so they will grow up and call upon the name of the Lord. There's a lot of parents who are concerned with their kids' education. They're concerned with their kids getting a good job. They're concerned with their kids making sure they're in little league sports because maybe someday they'll be a great athlete. They'll be a professional this or that. All these things. And those things are not necessarily bad. But those are things that people in the world are always striving for. And that's what Cain and his lineage was striving for. And they achieved those things. But they missed out on what was most important. Calling on the name of the Lord. What's our legacy going to be? What mark are we leaving behind? I hope it's not merely this legacy that Cain had. There's a lot of things you can learn when you look at these Old Testament narratives, a lot of lessons. I hope these things have been helpful to us. We can think about these things. I hope that we can apply them to our lives. If you're here this morning and you're not a Christian, we'd love to help you become one. We can study with you. If we can help you, we can baptize you into Jesus Christ. Let that be known. If you are a Christian, but you're an erring Christian, can we assist you? Whatever be your need. Won't you come on together, we stand and sing this song of encouragement.